So we've been talking a lot about benefiting others and compassion. And one of the first steps in actually doing that is to stop harming others. Okay? And so the development of compassion involves stopping harm and the mental states that cause harm, and then practicing benefiting and, you know, developing the mental states that encourage us to benefit others. So we have to talk about both aspects of it. So I thought I'd get into that a little bit today. Okay. So when we look at the mental factors, the emotions or attitudes or thoughts that or views that help us be a benefit to the world, of course we come up with love, the wish for others to have happiness in its causes, compassion, the wish for them to be free of suffering in its causes, generosity, ethical conduct, attitudes, mental factors, wisdom, that will enable us to be wise and skillful and compassionate in our lives. Then we can see the kinds of actions that flow from that. But then we look and we have to say, okay, then what interferes with me having those kinds of mental states and acting in the way that I would like to act? Okay, so one thing that I think you've discovered is the self-centered attitude. When we're self-preoccupied, you know, consider ourselves the most important one in the world, and everybody else is kind of props in our life. Yeah, they're there to make us happy. And we begin to see that anger is a big problem. Yeah, you can't have love and compassion in your mind at the same time you're really ticked off at someone, or if you have hatred, or jealousy, those interfere. Yeah, greed and just basic attachment, being attached to some things, feeling like I have to have these, and I deserve them. Subtext, more than everybody else. That kind of attachment, again, how are we going to have compassion if we're attached to the things that we like and don't want to give them up and just want to get more? And I'm not talking just about possessions here. It could be relationships. It could be social status. It could be power and influence. It could be fame. It could be praise and approval, but attachment to all the various things we look for from the outside, to boost us up. We begin to see that ignorance is a big problem too, when we can't tell what is virtuous and what's non-virtuous, when we don't know the nature of reality. Okay? So we see that within our mind, we have an array of really beautiful, beneficial qualities that right now are small, but they can grow bigger. Okay? And we also have a bunch of mental states and mental factors that definitely interfere with happiness, our own and other people's happiness. Yeah? So can you see that in your own life? Yeah? So a lot of what we consider normal behavior in society, from a Buddhist viewpoint, it actually creates misery. So, for example, with anger, Okay, everybody here get angry? We're with friends, we can admit it. Yeah, we get angry. Sometimes we even get angry at our friends. Okay, so a lot of times in society, people say, well, but anger is good. Yeah, I need to be angry to stand up for myself, otherwise people are going to walk all over me. I once was invited to a university, was it Michigan? Someplace back there, Minnesota. And I was speaking at, they had a department for communication and mediation department. So I was invited to give a talk there. And so I talked about the defects of anger and the ways to work with anger. And these people who were mediators, who worked at trying to get people to communicate, yeah, radically disagreed with me and said, no, anger is great. And they got really mad at me for talking about anger being a problem maker. Okay. It was very interesting. I was sitting there and they were all like, in attack mode, saying, you know, but we need to be angry because that's how we know something's wrong. You know, and if we're going to work for social justice, we need to be angry about the status quo. Okay, so that way of thinking is very widespread in society, that anger is considered good. Yeah, the problem with that way of thinking, well, there's many problems, but the thing that people often use to justify it is that's the only motivation you can have in order to correct social injustice. Okay? I don't agree with that at all. Okay? So you look at the situation of the Tibetans and the situation of the Palestinians. So right around the same time, the end of the 1940s, okay, beginning of the 1950s, Tibet was occupied by the communist Chinese. They lost their independence. You know, big problems. Then there was an abortive uprising. Tens of thousands of Tibetans had to become refugees in India. And then there was genocide in their country and environmental destruction and the whole nine yards. Palestinians had their land, okay? Then the Jews who were traumatized by the Holocaust, yeah, and certainly didn't want to go back to the places where they were from in Europe, I don't blame them at all, you know, came and got permission to start a new state. And the Arabs, the Palestinians who lived there, some of them were disenfranchised and their land seized. And they had been occupied by the British, so they didn't have their own country to start with. And that continued. Okay. So very similar situations for the two people, yeah, around the same time. Now, if you look historically, If you look at what the Palestinians have done to get their liberation, yeah, starting with Yasser Arafat and continuing on, how many people have been killed? Yeah, starting, you know, when it was probably before most of you were born, but the kidnapping and killing during the Olympics, yeah, all the uprisings, all the missiles thrown into Israel, and then Israel retaliates. Yeah, all the hijackings, all of this. How many people, how many Palestinians and other people, you know, have been killed in the Palestinian effort to get their own country? Okay. Then, how many Tibetans have been killed? Yeah, no hijackings, yeah, no importing of weapons and things like that. they had one small CIA-backed army that lasted, well, it wasn't even an army, but some kind of group that lasted a few years, and then that was it, but they didn't accomplish much or do much harm. And His Holiness Dalai Lama constantly tells the Tibetans, don't be angry at the Chinese. You know, the people who are working, they're just ordinary people trying to be happy. The government's what creates these problems. Yeah, don't be angry at them. The only, you know, the deaths that I can think of are the self-immolations, yeah, which have started in just in the recent years. So they're not attacking us and bystanders. So you have, like, a great number of people being killed in the Palestinian effort, which is based on anger, you know. Even when Yasser Arafat went to sign the thing with Rabin, when Clinton was over, you know, president, he had a pistol with him. And then you have the Tibetan struggle. Yeah. Neither people have their own state now, all these years later. Neither of them. How many people have died in the Palestinian struggle? How many people have died in the Tibetan struggle? Yeah, with His Holiness encouraging them not to be violent, to have compassion. Okay. So you see that we can oppose, and both movements have been actively opposing their suppressors, oppressors. But you can see that you can do that without being angry and without hating the other people. And in fact, I think when we're angry, then we actually become very much like the people that we are fighting against. Okay? Many years ago, I was in a Vietnam War protest at UCLA. And the cops were there, and we were here. And the guy next to me picked up a brick or a stone and was going to throw it at the cops. And I went, wait a minute, you know, your mind is becoming exactly like the mind of the people we are protesting. We were protesting a war. Yeah, when you throw something, that's a violent action. Yeah. So it really, I was, wow. Yeah, one of those moments that you never forget. Yeah. So, you know, for everybody who says, well, anger is beneficial and you need it, please think again, okay? And even in interpersonal relationships, do we need to be angry in order to clarify or resolve a dispute? Do we even need to create disputes to start with by imputing negative emotions on other people? Okay. Or can we approach disagreements with a mind that sees everybody actually wants to resolve this? Yeah. And nobody wants to remain in a state of polarized, tension. And so to come together and try and resolve something, recognizing that, compromise will probably be necessary, but isn't peace worth compromise? Yeah. So, you know, to really think about that, you know. We're talking, I think the first night, you know, about wanting to be right and pushing arguments. Remember? Seemed a long time ago, doesn't it? Only Friday. And how we, you know, we have to prove we're right and we have to win the argument. Yeah. What about, you know, taking that out of the equation? We don't have to prove we're right. You know, we can discuss a situation and brainstorm together ways to solve it. Okay. There's a very nice book that was written many years ago called Getting to Yes. And I can't remember who wrote it now, but it was very famous at the time, so I'm sure you can get it. And it was saying having the mental picture when there's a conflict, instead of me on one side of the table, the other people, person on the other side of the table, and we're fighting over what's in the middle, to view it as, okay, the disagreement is here, the thing to be resolved is here, but the other person and I are sitting on the same side of the table. Yeah. So we're not starting off as opponents, we're starting off as collaborators who want to solve this problem. So that shift in our mind can be very, very important, you know, because we're seeing the other person in a different way. When you think, who do we get the most angry with? Strangers or people we care about? People we care about. Doesn't that seem strange to you that we get the most angry at the people we love? We say the most horrible, horrible things to the people that we care about the most. We would never talk to a stranger the way we talk to the people we care about. Yeah? You get angry at a family member? What comes out of the mouth is astounding. We would never talk to them like that to a stranger, you know? Even somebody hits our car, we may yell at them and call them a jerk and why don't you look where you're going? But that's nothing compared to what we say to the people we care about and what we accuse them of doing. Yeah? Isn't that strange? And then we say the most outrageous things to those people. And then we wonder why they don't trust us after that. Yeah. And we wonder why it's so difficult to communicate with them. Yeah. So trust in relationships takes a long time to build up. Does, you know, because you have to know somebody well and see them in many different situations to build up trust. But trust can be broken very quickly. And then it takes a long time to build it up again. So it's something, you know, to watch what anger does in our mind and what comes out of our mouth and also what we may do physically. People say, I would never hit somebody I love. You know, the rate of domestic abuse in this country, well, all over the world, is awful. You know, who do you take it out on? You beat your wife. You beat your kids. Yeah. So, anger, you know, it doesn't really benefit us, does it? I mean, it tears things down and then makes us suspicious. We withdraw. We don't trust. Yeah. Russell was talking about safety yesterday. Yeah. We don't feel safe. Sometimes we don't feel safe physically, even in your own house. Sometimes we don't feel safe emotionally because there's somebody with an out-of-control temper, and you don't know when it's going to explode and when it's going to hit you and what they're going to say. And then the worst is when we become that person with an out-of-control temper. Yeah. And then we explode and say those things. And then afterwards, how do we feel about ourselves? You know, one part of the mind may say, well, I feel great. I put that person in their place. I won the argument. So you might think that for about 5 minutes. Okay. Is the other person going to cooperate with you after that? They may capitulate because they're afraid. But capitulation and cooperation are very different. So what's this thing? You can win the battle but lose the war? Yeah, so you won the battle. The other person gave up. But you're losing the war because they're not a happy person. And you're going to be living with a person who doesn't trust you, who is unhappy. That's not going to be much fun. Okay, so to really look, not just at what other people do, but at what we do, and what we do, and what's going on in our own mind. So we, at Christmas, you know, we write, may everybody live in peace, may all beings be happy. You know, standard Christmas card, New Year's card. And then Christmas dinner. Yeah? How many Christmas dinners are peaceful? Or Thanksgiving, you know, we're supposed to give thanks. So there's a reason for calling it the nuclear family. Okay? Because sometimes indeed it is nuclear. So, you know, often in family things, everybody has a role. Have you noticed this? And so every family dinner, you know, person A makes fun of person B. Person B gets aggravated and irritated. Yeah. And then they say some sharp things to person C. Or they're upset because of what person A did, so they withdraw and go to another room, and then the rest of the people at the dinner are upset because one member of the family went out. So then, you know, person C quarrels with person A because A said that to B, and then D says to C, why are you picking on B for saying that? You do the same thing. Yeah? And you have a wonderful, intimate family dinner. Okay? So, you know, and we are actors in this. And especially in families where you know somebody very, very well. So you know exactly what their buttons are. Yeah. And you know, I can push that person's button and get them really ticked off and look completely innocent at the same time. Yeah? So we know exactly what I can say to that person that they're sensitive about, but I can say it so sweetly as a joke or slip it into another conversation with somebody else, but they hear it. Yeah, and it gets them going. Yeah. And I have a sense of power. Of course, they do that to us too. And they know our buttons, and they may say the things that push our buttons, you know? So they're throwing out the hook. And then we stupidly bite the hook. Because we're sensitive about certain things, and that person just mentioned it. And so I bite the hook and I go into defensive mode and I have to protect myself and show that person they're wrong. Or I withdraw and have a pity party. How many of you explode when you're upset? How many of you have a pity party how many of you do one or the other depending on the situation? Yeah? Okay. So here we are, we all want to be happy. We all don't want to suffer. But, you know, by having anger in the mind, we make ourselves suffer because nobody's happy when they're angry. We make others suffer by what we say and do. That boomerangs back because when we make somebody else suffer, they're going to retaliate in one way or another. Maybe not retaliate by doing something gross, but they will withdraw. And here it is, a person that we want to be friends with, and they've withdrawn because they don't trust us. Okay? So, my point here is, if you think that there's benefit to anger, think again. And think if there's other mental states that can help you solve disagreements. Okay. You say the offering service prayer, don't you, every afternoon? So it talks about there may be differences of opinions, but we don't need to make these into conflicts. Yeah. So we don't need to say, this is my idea. And my idea equals me. So if you don't like my idea, that means you don't like me. That's what's going on in the country now. You know, you don't like my idea, that means you don't like me. I don't like your idea, so that means I don't like you. But sometimes, if we look behind, what we're both looking for is the same, or what our value is the same. Yeah. It may be hard to understand, yeah, but when you think of the people who disagree with you politically, yeah, many of those people think they're not just working for their own welfare, they think what they're doing is of benefit to society. Whatever side they're on, we think we're benefiting society. They think they're benefiting society too. Yeah. You told me the other day about, was it your uncle?
Yeah.
Yeah. So one or two.
Yeah, my uncle was a big Vietnam War protester back in the day. And then like a year or whatever later after the protests, and he was very liberal, very hippie, everything. And then he inherited $1 million. Suddenly became Republican, and now he has a castle in Carmel with a Ferrari collection, and he's a big Republican donor, and he's always talking about how he worked hard for his money and doesn't want to give it up. And we're always getting into fights. Always.
It's your uncle?
No. Yeah.
My uncle did the same thing.
Yeah.
He doesn't have a Ferrari.
You know, so, but if you ask them, like your uncle says, he's creating jobs for people.
Oh, that part, yeah.
Yeah? So he says, I'm doing what benefits the country. I'm creating jobs for people. And you say, but those people need something to eat before they go to their job. Yeah? And so both parties are feeling like, you know, they're advocating policies that will benefit others. But how you benefit is different. Yeah, what you consider a help is different. Okay. So it's, I really advocate talking to people who grew up different than you did, who had different life experiences, who have different views, because it is so interesting getting to hear why they think what they think. You know, you may disagree up, down, and across, but it really helps you understand living beings and to develop respect and tolerance for people. Because you see what, you know, what their you know, why they do what they do, and how in their paradigm what they do makes sense. In your paradigm, what they do may not make sense. But also what you do in their in your paradigm makes sense to you, but it doesn't make sense to them. Okay? And so to try somehow, just out of curiosity, it's not a thing of convincing somebody of another view. You know, you're entitled to your view, so are they. We don't have to fight over it, because definitely people are not going to change their views if you quarrel and scream and, you know, you've said you've discovered that, yeah, with your uncle. That's not going to change anything. But it's really fascinating to hear about other people's lives and why they think what they think. Yeah? And, you know, to be able to find something you can talk about, some interesting topic that both you and the other person are interested in that you can share. Yeah? So I was thinking, because the other day I commented on Ivanka. Now, Ivanka and I are about as far away as you can get. Okay? You know, I don't spend how much every time she does fixing my face every morning. You know, dyeing my hair, making it look perfect, getting the right clothes, worrying about my figure, and, you know, touting that I have a wealthy husband and da-da-da. You know, so Ivanka and I don't think we're going to, you know, we're really, really different. But I think if I were to ever meet her, we could find things, topics that we're both interested in to discuss. Okay? So what I'm interested in with Ivanka is she converted to Judaism. Yeah, very few people convert to Judaism. I was born Jewish. I grew up Jewish. And then I became Buddhist. So I'm very curious about why she wanted to be, I mean, aside from the fact that to marry her husband who was an Orthodox Jew, she had to, you know. She goes to shul every week, and like, why, and what do you get out of it? And, you know, do you do the mikvah, and do you do all this other stuff? I'm really quite curious. So I think we could have a very interesting conversation about that. We wouldn't talk about makeup, you know. And we wouldn't talk about, you know, who does our nails. yeah. And we wouldn't talk about, you know, what property she wants to buy in Manhattan, because I'm not interested at all in that. But I'm sure we could find something to discuss. Okay? And that would, you know, gives you a way, an avenue into seeing something about, oh, what's that person like on the inside? Yeah? Why do you convert to marry your husband? And do you believe what you convert to? And, you know, you go to shul every week, so you must believe something. What do you believe? How does it benefit you spiritually? Yeah? What did you think when you went to Israel? So that kind of thing, you know, would be very interesting to find out from her, you know, from her husband, who I think I'm even more far apart with. You know, I want to ask him, you know, how can you be the grandchild of a Holocaust survivor and think the way you do about immigration in America? Yeah, I really don't understand that. But I'm not going to attack him over it. That's not going to do any good. But I'm very curious. Yeah. Because I grew up in the shadow of the Holocaust, and that influenced me tremendously, you know, a lot of my views. And I'm so curious. How can you be the grandchild of a Holocaust survivor, you know, and see the number tattooed on your grandmother or grandfather's arm and have that view about immigration? I don't get it. And it would be fascinating for me to be able to ask him, why do you think that way? How did you get to that conclusion? Yeah? Like I said, my goal is not to change him. My goal is to communicate. It would be to communicate. Yeah, to connect with some other person. Yeah. And one of the big fallacies we have is that to connect with somebody, we have to agree with them. That's a big fallacy. That is not true. Okay? His Holiness Dalai Lama is very close with one Catholic priest. You can see I'm very bad at names. So I can't remember his name, but they have a lot of dialogue together. And one time, the Catholic priest, when they were having a public dialogue, said, you know, when you really look at it, Buddhism and Catholicism come down to the same thing. And, you know, we practice almost the same ways, you know. And His Holiness, and so the priest was saying, you know, therefore, you know, we should definitely get along. And His Holiness said, you know, I don't agree with that. We have different philosophies. We don't, you know, I mean, and they do, very different philosophies. The Catholics assert a self-existent soul. The Buddhists say such a thing doesn't exist. And it's a key part of the Buddhist doctrine. So there's some very big doctrinal differences. But His Holiness said we don't need to agree in order to get along. So many people, you know, when they talk to me in courses, they say, you know, don't you think all world religions come to the same point? And they desperately want me to say yes, you know? And I say, you know, I have no idea, because I have not reached the final point of the path that I practice, let alone practice somebody else's path and see where it goes. I cannot say that all religions, the end point is the same thing. Yeah? No way I can say that. But we can still get along with each other, and we can still respect each other. So there's a very small Catholic nunnery. They have only two or three people that live, you know, fairly close to us, and we see them from time to time, and have for many, many years. Yeah. And we talk about all sorts of things, you know, how we live our faith. We don't quarrel, but our belief system, you know, in many areas is very different in terms of the theology, very different. In terms of social issues, we're much more on the same page. Yeah? In terms of how to deal with patriarchy, that's a difficult one. I've done interfaith dialogues with Catholic nuns. That's something difficult because they don't want to come out and, you know, and say anything against the church. But you can see that they're writhing under the influence of it. Okay? Okay. But my whole point here is that when we really open our mind and our heart, we can communicate with everybody, I think. Yeah. I mean, wouldn't it be very interesting to talk to one of those Saudi princes? You know, the one who wants to modernize, what's the MBW? No, yeah, MBW. No. Anyway, the one who's a big shot right now in Saudi Arabia. No, you know, it was MWB. Anyway, him. Okay, yeah, I told you I wasn't very good with names. And it seems like none of you know his name either. He says he wants to modernize the country. He was supportive of women driving, but then he locked up all the women activists right before the law went into effect saying women could drive. And he also supported the assassination of that journalist whose name starts with a K that I can't remember. And it has an H and a G and an O in it. Maybe you remember his
Khashoggi
name.
Khashoggi or something.
Yeah, something like that. Okay. I told that. I can't even remember John and Susan. Okay. Because I meet a lot of people. So please, in future years, if I ask you what your name is, don't get mad at me. So, you know, wouldn't it be fascinating? They're negotiating a deal now for the Saudis to make very sensitive weaponry parts that have to do with something with the nuclear missiles in Saudi Arabia. Is that a smart policy for the U.S. to do that? I don't think so. But wouldn't it be fascinating to talk to that prince? And, you know, I want to understand how you think, how you want to modernize the country, but then how you lock up dissidents. Yeah, I wouldn't say it like that to him. I would approach it in a different way, you know, because if you're confrontational, they shut down. But you can approach it in a different way and then draw out somebody's thoughts and try and understand the way they think. Yeah? And my point is, when you connect with an individual person, your stereotypes about a group go away. Yeah? Because stereotypes are based on putting everybody in one box. Yeah? And not seeing the difference. When we talk to individuals, we see people's humanity. Yeah? Okay. So that's about anger. So we have to do something with our anger if we want to be compassionate, don't we? Yeah. Because, you know, anger is really going to destroy stuff. So there's a whole book downstairs called Working with Anger you can use. There's another one that His Holiness Dalai Lama wrote called Taming Anger.
Healing
anger. Yeah. So, you know, that one too. They're both based on the writings of an 8th century Indian sage named Shantideva, yeah, who spoke a lot about, you know, how, what to do with anger. So, no, very helpful to learn these methods. So, yeah, one of the methods for working with anger has to do with karma. And seeing that, I guess the modern way of putting it is whatever goes around comes around. Yeah. Or you reap what you sow. No. But the idea is that the energy we put out and how we treat others affects not only others, but it affects us too. We usually think what we say or do, you know, just affects other people. It doesn't. Yeah. Based on our motivation, it affects us. Yeah. And we leave, for lack of a better word, energy traces or karmic seeds, yeah, of the actions we do on our own mind stream. So we may get really angry and say horrible things to somebody. That affects them. But it leaves on our own mind stream the karmic seeds of harsh speech. Yeah, harsh speech is unwholesome, yeah, or non-virtuous, whatever word you want to use. Okay, so we put that energy out, we left the seeds of it in our own mind stream. Those seeds, when the cooperative conditions around are ripe, and when they are nourishing, that seed, and it's not a physical seed, but that seed will ripen in terms of what we ourselves experience. So at the time of death, it can influence what we're reborn as. During our life, even as a human being, it can influence what we experience. It can influence some of our habits. It can influence the type of environment that we're born into. Yeah, whether you're born in an arid place with no crops, whether you're born in a place that floods all the time, you know. So the place we're born into as well. Okay, so when you really think about it, it's not just a thing of harming others. Whenever we harm others, we harm ourselves. Whenever we benefit others, we benefit ourselves because we put the seeds of virtuous actions on our mind stream. And when those ripen, then we have good results. Okay. So we can look at our life now, and what we experience, we can see, is the result of some virtuous actions we've done in the past and some non-virtuous actions we've done in the past. Okay? We're born humans. That's something considered very good, you know, in terms of the spiritual path. Because unlike our kitties or the turkeys or the, you know, all the other insects around, we have the possibility of learning about the teachings and thinking about them and taming our mind and choosing how to act. Okay? These other living beings don't have that kind of intelligence to think about that and make those kind of choices. Yeah, their minds are mostly just, you know, my happiness now. And they act on that. And most human beings act on my happiness now too. You know, not using, we don't always use our human intelligence to think about what, you know, what's going on in my mind and what's the effect of my actions going to be on other people and what's the effect of my actions going to be on my own mind, my own situation. Okay, we often don't think about that, but we have the potential to. Okay. So our being born as human beings is a result of good karma. Okay. Specifically, we kept good ethical conduct in previous lives. We're born in a place where there's food. Yeah? Anybody here ever had a totally empty refrigerator where there's absolutely nothing to eat? And you have no money to go out and get anything? You know, we've been extremely fortunate. So that, again, is a result of virtuous karma. Probably the karma of being generous, giving to other people, so we have what we need. Anybody here who's never been criticized? Yeah? We've all been criticized, right? Yeah. Anybody here has never been made fun of by somebody else? So we've experienced these painful situations of being made fun of being criticized. You know, when we were kids, when we're adults. Yeah, this is universal, isn't it? Yeah. Those are unhappy experiences. They're the result of non-virtuous actions that we've done. Yeah. Times when we've spoken harshly to others, when we've ridiculed others, when we've bullied others. Yeah. It may be in this lifetime, even when we were younger, or it could also be in previous lifetimes. Because the karmic seeds from the actions we do in one life, you know, are on the mind stream, and our mind stream continues from one life to the next, and it brings those seeds with it until those seeds ripen. Okay. So one thing that I find very helpful when people criticize me or speak harshly to me, instead of instantly going into defensive mode, a about how I really have to explain to them that what they're thinking is wrong and what I did was really right. And it's a big misunderstanding, and don't be mad at me because I'm really a nice person. Blah, 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 blah. Okay. Instead of thinking that I, you know, go into that defensive thing. Or attack mode of, you know, how dare you say that to me? To think, well, I've dished out criticism to other people. So anybody here who's never criticized anybody else? To their face, behind their back? We all have. Okay. You're all sitting there like, you're not nodding your heads. Yes, I've criticized others, but I know you have. Either that or you're very highly spiritually realized. Yeah. So it helps me, you know, when somebody criticizes me, maybe my feelings are hurt, I feel misunderstood, I feel neglected, I feel upset and angry, I feel like the world is unfair, to reflect that I've criticized other people. And if I look only this lifetime, not even thinking about previous lives, only this lifetime, and I look, how often do I criticize other people? Every day. Yeah, if I'm truthful, every day I find some fault with somebody and verbalize it. It could even be a small fault. I wrote a note on the dryer the other day. In the summer, do not use the dryer. Hang the wet clothes out on the lawn, the line to dry. Yeah. I could have written that just as a piece of information. But I didn't. I was ticked off because I was looking for my wet clothes. And somebody had them in the dryer instead of on the line. Okay? So that note was written, motivated by some irritation, and irritation's a form of anger. Okay? So that's a small incident. Yeah. I'm not copying to the big ones that I do. I'm telling you a small one I did the other day. I've done some big ones. Okay? Yeah. When I really look at how often in my life I criticize others, and I compare it to how often I receive criticism, it's not even. I criticize others much more than I receive criticism. So when people do criticize me, why do I think it's unfair? Why do I complain about it when I've dished out the same thing to them? And actually, I've dished out more than I'm receiving. Yeah? So instead of getting angry or feeling sorry for myself or whatever, just to say, you know, this is a result of my own actions. And sometime in the past, motivated by anger, I said something mean to somebody, and now it is coming back to me. So why am I getting so upset? Yeah, it's just the boomerang. I threw the boomerang out. If I don't like what's coming back to me, I need to change what I'm sending out. I can't blame the other person for criticizing me when the real root of the thing is my own negative action. Okay. So if I don't want to be criticized, I have to change how I speak, and that entails changing my mind. And then when I think like that, I don't get angry at other people. Yeah, because I realize that, you know, it's really not their thing why my feelings are hurt. Yeah, it's a thing of my own doing. So I don't blame myself like, oh, what a terrible person I am. I've created so much negative karma. and making a drama. Yeah, because that drama is totally uncalled for. It's off the topic. It doesn't solve the problem. You know? It's like when you spill milk, just sit there and wail about, oh, how terrible I am, I spilled the milk. Meanwhile, the milk is soaking into the carpeting. You know? So, you know, it's like, okay, let's stop the internal drama and deal with the situation. Okay? And so then what happens is then I see, okay, when I'm criticized, there's something I can do to prevent this kind of thing happening again. And so I need to change my ways, and then I go about slowly changing my ways. Okay? So that's one way to deal with anger. There's many, many, many different ways. But I think I've talked quite a bit so far. Maybe you have some questions or comments?
Mm-hmm. So I have a question related to both like karma or to karma, anger, and Tibet. So like like Palestine, I don't know much about these conflicts, but like Palestine, if they're fighting against Israel, they like is Tibet anywhere closer to getting their land back from China?
No.
But Palestine might be a bit closer to getting their land back from Israel.
I don't think so.
Don't think so? Okay.
You're not with the present government.
Okay.
Not with Bibi in charge. Uh-uh. In fact, somebody from the U.S. recently said that they think Israel has a right to annex the West Bank. That's making it even further away.
So basically, angry or not, nobody's getting anywhere?
Yeah.
Okay. And then my second question was, so like, with all the Buddhists in Tibet, what sort of karma did these people get to have their land stripped and their all these other nuns killed?
Okay. So clearly in their previous lives, you know, they must have taken the land of others or done something, you know, along that line. Some of the property of others who deprived them of their property, you know, could be by governmental means, it could be by violence, who knows. But they weren't necessarily Tibetans when they did that action. So you can be a Tibetan in this life, but have been born, a southerner during the time of slavery in a previous life, created the karma there, then experience it when you're born as a Tibetan. Okay? Yeah. But so neither of those two sides are closer, in my view anyway, to getting their own country. But who has the moral high ground? Who has more sympathy in the world? Yeah, the Tibetans do, don't they? And so His Holiness speaks out on behalf of autonomy in Tibet. It's not like he, you know, rolls over and says, oh, well, yeah, they occupied our country. That's okay with me. He doesn't say that. He talks about, you know, the harm that's been done to Tibet. Yeah. But he does it with a voice of compassion and saying, don't hate the oppressors.
Mm-hmm. Personally, I have more sympathy for Tibet for that reason. Mm-hmm. Not maybe much more, but I mean a little bit, certainly, because of their moral high ground. But do you think they have more sympathy, especially in the West, because of their ethics, or do you think it's because the West and developed regions are racist and xenophobic against Islam and people of darker skin colors?
Well, the Tibetans are darker skin colored too. And they're another religion.
The Middle Eastern people?
Yeah, some of them.
So do you think it's more the hatred of Islam? Not more, but do you think that plays a role as well?
I think it plays a role. You know, the West doesn't have as much to do with Buddhism. And Buddhism isn't a confrontational religion. Yeah. So, you know, you destroy ancient Buddhist artifacts. I wish the Buddhists would speak up more. You know, I'm not saying be violent, but at least say more. Yeah? Whereas, you know, Islam, due to the religion, then they really stand up when that kind of thing happens. Okay?
How do you deal with past karma? It's changing it now.
How do I deal with what?
Past karma.
Our parents' karma.
Past
karma. Okay, that's where the purification comes in. Remember, I was talking 2 days ago about those 4 steps of regretting, restoring the relationship, making a determination not to do it again, and then doing some kind of remedial virtuous action. Yeah, that's how we counteract past negative karma and impede it from ripening. It can, yeah, when our past karma ripens and we're in certain situations, then we create new karma. Okay, so this is one trick to, this is actually where spiritual practice is so important. So let's say in a past life, I criticize somebody, you know, and now in this life, they criticize me. So that's the ripening of my past karma. And now I'm in that situation of I feel hurt and, you know, misunderstood and everything like that. At that point, I have a choice. Yeah. We don't often see our choices, but we have a choice. I could either go along with my feelings of I'm hurt, I'm misunderstood, it's not fair, and get really mad at the person who criticized me. In which case, I'm going to be creating negative karma by getting angry and criticizing, speaking harshly to somebody else. Or, that person criticized me, I feel hurt, misunderstood, and I say to myself, well, it's actually the result of my own past negative action. There's no need to get mad at that other person. So I'm not mad, but I'm going to sit down and kind of discuss the situation with somebody and, you know, think about what they said because, yeah, I might have made that mistake, in which case I need to own the mistake. Yeah? Or even I didn't make that mistake. If I discuss it with them, then I can give them the information they need so that they don't, you know, they aren't mad and they don't criticize me. If we choose that road, then we're not angry, yeah? We're acting out of a mind that wants to reach a helpful conclusion. And so we at that point, we actually create virtuous karma. Even though we're experiencing the result of non-virtue, at that moment we create virtue. Okay? So in any particular situation, we could be experiencing the result of virtue and non-virtue, or non-virtue, but we, in other words, experiencing happiness or experiencing suffering. But at that point, we have a choice what kind of karma we're going to create for, that will influence our future. Okay? So sometimes, okay, we experience the result of virtuous karma, yeah, and we have a choice then to create more virtue or to create non-virtue. Okay? So his uncle, yeah? So he inherited $1 million. That's said to be a result of virtuous karma. Now, at that point, you know, let's say he decided to open a charity and out of sincere generosity give some of that money to other people. That would be, he would be experiencing the result of virtue and and creating more virtue through generosity. Or he could inherit that money and say, I'm keeping it all for myself. Yeah, I don't care about these other people. This is my money. If I want to buy a jet with it, it's my business. Those poor people who are poor, it's their fault because they don't work hard and they don't pick themselves up by their own bootstraps. Of course, he didn't either. He inherited the money. But that's a very good example of somebody experiencing the result of virtue, but then, you know, manufacturing a non-virtuous attitude of miserliness and contempt. And in that way, you experience the result of virtue, but you create the cause of, you create more non-virtue through it. Okay. So that's why we need to be really, you know, on the ball and be aware of what's going on in our mind and how we're acting. Okay, make some sense? Okay. Yeah.
I don't know if we've discussed this in our discussion groups. I don't think so, but some of us have asked questions about, like, hell beings and hungry ghosts and all that. So, like, the idea of hell beings that have been suffering for eons because they have so much non-virtuous karma, how would a being like that ever get out of that cycle?
Yeah, I think somebody asked that before, and I was saying that they may have been a human before. And in addition to creating the cause to be born in the hell realms, they also created some virtue. So when the cause, the karmic cause for the hell realm is exhausted, then that other karma may ripen and they can have a good rebirth afterwards.
So they cannot react?
Oh, what do you mean they can't react?
Yes, I mean for the bad karma to end, and then the good one can come. Mm-hmm. They cannot have this kind of reaction to the what's happening because then they would accumulate more.
Yeah, and that's what's difficult. It's like once you're born in those realms, sometimes it's difficult to create virtuous karma because the external situation is so powerful that it's hard as an ordinary being to arouse a virtuous mind. But there's a story of the Buddha in one previous life when he was a bodhisattva where he, you know, was undergoing some horrible suffering together with somebody else in the hell realm. And he generated the thought, by my undergoing this, may it suffice for that person's pain. And somehow the power of that virtuous thought purified the rest of his karma to be born in the hell realm, and he was very quickly born in a better rebirth.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to ask. Like, can we, like, give up some of our, like, merit? Like, I don't know, like say Trey has bought a lot of, like, bad karma, like, but I have merit. Can I dedicated?
Yeah, like do a bank transfer.
Yeah.
No. No. There's no such thing as a karmic bank transfer. Okay. Because we each create our own actions, so we experience the result of the actions we create. When somebody is having difficulties, one practice that we do is we may create virtue, and then we dedicate that virtue for them. Of course, that doesn't move it over so that they'll experience the result of that. We experience. But the fact of our praying and dedicating and, you know, sending good wishes, that can create like an ambience so that that other person's own virtuous karma can ripen.
So it creates the environment to make that easier?
Yeah. Yeah. This will be the last question. Yeah.
So I know that there's that story about how in one of the Buddha's previous lives, he was the ship captain or something.
Right, yes.
He had to kill the guy.
Yeah.
So there's that. So I was wondering, in these, like in the the Tibetan example or the Palestinian example, mm-hmm. or even just in this country, movements for, you know, mm-hmm. for persecuted minorities, if there was a way to separate the anger from the violence, would violence ever be an appropriate response? Mm.
Okay. If you have a mind that is has compassion for everybody in the situation, not just the oppressed people, but you have compassion for the oppressors who are doing the horrible things, and you want to protect both of them from creating negative karma, and you are willing to spend however long the karmic retribution is, you know, yourself, if you must, being born in a lower realm, and you're willing to undergo whatever may happen in this life, like being sentenced and thrown in prison or subjugated to the death penalty. So your compassion is so great, and you have the wisdom that sees that by doing this, it's going to save many people a lot of suffering in the future. Then, as a bodhisattva, go ahead. Okay, now, do you have that level of compassion? Do you have that level of wisdom? Yeah, I don't know about you. Are you willing to spend eons in a lower realm? Are you willing to, you know, have people try and assassinate you because of what the violence you've done in your struggle? Yeah? So it's difficult. It's difficult. Lots of time that story is told, and then people take it and rationalize it. Oh, yes, I have so much compassion for the oppressed people. I hate the oppressors. Look what they're doing. But I love the oppressed people. Yeah, I have so much compassion. So, yeah, I'm going to stand up and be violent. Yeah. And then when the police come after them or the other gang comes after them, the other gang can also be the police. You know, then it's like, wait, why are you doing this to me? This isn't fair. Yeah, they don't want to go to prison.
Russell mentioned that story yesterday, bringing that up. If anybody did a recent BBC on the sutra, which you actually went, you found the sutra, went back to it and read it.
Yeah.
I wanted to mention it then, but I didn't fit. There's a lot of qualifications around, like, who the people were that he killed. There are realized beings who wouldn't ever go to a lower realm, so the person knew that. I mean, there's just so many qualifications. We can send you the link to that BBC if you'd like to watch.
Yeah.
I guess when I hear that story about the murder on the ship, the first thing that comes to mind in this modern day and age is just the mass shootings that happen, like a school shooting. Mm-hmm. Or so, and I'm not saying I would have the bravery to do this, but, like, I mean, to stop somebody that's, you know, doing that, like, to rush them and mm-hmm. to attack them. I mean,
there's a difference between rushing somebody and, you know, what do you... incapacitating them, I mean, and shooting them. There's a difference.
What if all you have is a gun? Shoot them in the kneecaps or something?
Yeah.
Instead?
Yeah.
Try your best not to kill them.
That's really hard, though, with guns.
You know, you may have to incapacitate them, but you don't have to kill them. Mm-hmm. So, you know, so Buddhism is not saying, oh, don't defend yourself. No, defend yourself, but you know.
Hesitation to the point of accidentally paralyzing the person be worse than killing them?
I don't want to get into the details.
I know, it's important. I would
say keep saving the life, even if they're paralyzed, is much better than killing them.
Yep.
Yeah. Because what everybody cherishes the most is their own life. Isn't it? Isn't that what you cherish the most? You would give up your property and things like that, but your life? Yeah, that's what we cherish the most.
Thank you for addressing the detail.
Yeah.
I appreciate it. Just in case we're ever in something.
Yeah, well, I hope you never are.
Yeah, me
either. Yeah. Yeah. And I certainly don't think that having guns in schools is going to solve the problem. Yeah. I mean, the whole philosophy of a good guy killing a bad guy, you know, I mean, because eventually the police are going to come and they're not going to know who the good guy is and who the bad guy is. They're going to shoot at whoever has a gun. So, doesn't make much sense. Don't get me on the talking about gun rights. That is a real soapbox for me. Yeah, I feel very strongly, you know, about getting rid of all of them. If I had my way, I would even revoke the Second Amendment. Don't tell anybody. I'm telling you because I think you're on my side. But I just met you. I don't know if you're on my side. You're on
your side.
You're on my side. Cody's not going to take out a gun against me. But, yeah, I mean, because I've lived in Singapore, and, you know, as a woman, you're always on the lookout. When you're a woman, you know, aren't you? Yeah, always. You know, guys never think about it, but we always have to be careful. I lived in Singapore. As a woman, you can take the bus home, walk from the bus station to your flat. Nobody is going to bother you. Yeah? I would go out. I do exercise early in the morning, and I would go out for walks. Early in the morning, I feel totally safe. Nobody has a gun there. Yeah? And, yeah, the whole attitude in the country is very different. So it's nice. It's nice to live in a place where people aren't going to pull out a gun when you're in the movie theater and shoot you because you're too tall. Yeah? There was one case where that happened. Yeah, do you remember that? There was a couple, and the man was calling home because they had a toddler. It was one of the, you know, and the toddler was with the babysitter. So during the movie, he made a very short phone call to call the babysitter, make sure the baby was okay. Yeah. Well, the person behind him got furious and started yelling and screaming at him. And he stood up to turn around and talk to the guy. And the other guy pulled out a gun and killed him. This is the father. You know, now this child is going to grow up without a dad. Yeah? So, don't get me going. Don't get me going. Okay. Let's sit for a minute and digest. Let's dedicate. Due to this merit, may we soon attain the awakened state of Guru Buddha, that we may be able to liberate all sentient beings from their sufferings. May the precious Bodhi mind, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forever.